Lecture 2, The Historical Study of Language, Methods and Approaches.
Hello. Welcome back to the history of the English language. This is Lecture 2, where we're going to explore some of the problems, methods, and ways of studying language historically. But before I begin, let me review some of the key points of my last lecture. In Lecture 1, I outlined the ways in which the study of the history of the English language can, as it were, be motivated by, or even inform, our understanding of how we speak and write today. I raised a series of questions about contemporary debates about the relationship between spelling and pronunciation, about the notion of grammar or standard or regional variation. I used terms like archaism. I gave an example of a particular kind of language or sound change, metathesis. And I tried to stress that our study of English can be informed not only by historical documents, but by our own experience. Now, in this lecture, I'd like to present some of the key ways of studying language historically. I want to also remind you that our primary goal is a historical narrative, a beginning at what passes for the beginning, and an ending, perhaps not with the end, but with the future. Before we begin with this beginning, we should ask ourselves first what language is. Now, scholars for the past, 3,000 years have been asking what language is. And I can't presume to give a definition, but what I can presume to do is offer us some working categories. And at the close of this lecture, what I'm going to call some myths about language, language change, and language variety. What I think we can do, too, is, if not define language, at the very least, define the ways in which we're going to study language. And here, we need a practical method for the study of language in its contemporary and in its historical contexts. And I think that there are, broadly speaking, three tools that we can use to study language. The first is called articulatory phonetics. Articulatory phonetics is the study of how sounds are produced in the human mouth. Phoneticians have come up with precise ways of describing how those sounds are produced, where they're located in the mouth, what means the mouth uses to produce sounds, and how we can develop a precise and technical vocabulary for describing and recording sounds. Now, this is not a course in phonetics, but it is a course in language history in which phonetics will play a part. And I just want to pause a little bit to say a few things about what we will be doing with sounds and sound production in this course. It's important to understand that the mouth is shaped in a very special way, and that each part of the mouth has a name that refers to the way in which sounds are produced. Sounds produced with the lips are labial sounds. Sounds produced with the teeth are dental sounds. This seems pretty straightforward. Of course, as you move backwards into the mouth, you get to parts of the mouth that we don't normally talk about. Sounds produced on the ridge just behind the teeth, the alveolar ridge of the mouth, are alveolar sounds. Sounds produced at the palate are palatal sounds. Move back. Sounds produced in the velum are velar sounds. If you were to go further back into your mouth, you'd hit your glottis. Now, English does not have glottal sounds that are meaningful sounds in the language, by which I mean we may make glottal stops, but that's not a meaningful sound. Yet there are languages in which glottal stops are meaningful sounds. So we need to have that as a concept. We need to talk about consonants and vowels. The major difference between consonants and vowels, and I think a good way of thinking of this difference, is to say that vowels are continuously produced sounds, and consonants are not. Consonants, in effect, stop or interrupt or inflect, in some sense, the production of sound in the mouth. The places of the mouth that I've described to you are the places where consonants are made. Vowels are described not by those places, but where they are in the height of the mouth. A high vowel like E, a back vowel like O, a front vowel like OO, a low vowel like AH. This is, I think, the broad contours of what we need to know about articulatory phonetics. Not just to describe how we speak or how certain sounds work, but also to understand how certain sound changes took place. To describe changes in consonants or vowels, we need to have this vocabulary. And we need to know where the sounds are in our mouths. Now, in addition to articulatory phonetics, another tool for studying language history and structure is what's called sociolinguistics. That is, the study of language in society, social attitudes towards language variation, use, and change. Sociolinguistics is a very broad category that can embrace many things. It can embrace the history of attitudes towards language, but it can also really be a subset of what we might call experimental or empirical sociology. Fieldwork in sociolinguistics. How do people speak? What are social attitudes towards language as we can record them? We think of sociolinguistics, or we think of sociology, as perhaps a uniquely contemporary discipline or practice. Yet there were sociolinguists working in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. Some of the writers we will be examining in this course might be considered the sociolinguists of their day. A man like Walter of Bibbesworth, a 13th century English writer who writes a French and English treatise for aristocrats, is someone describing social attitudes towards language. 16th and 17th century grammarians who reflect on language change, regional variation, spelling conventions, how certain classes or groups of people speak. They are sociolinguists. Samuel Johnson, the maker of the dictionary in the mid-18th century, is in his own way a sociolinguist, as are the lexicographers and grammarians who succeeded him. The third category of method, in addition to articulatory phonetics and sociolinguistics, is what has come to be called comparative philology. Now, philology really simply means the love of words or the love of language. But as a discipline, philology has, since the middle of the 19th century, come to mean the historical and empirical study of how language changes, the way in which particular laws or rules of sound change have operated historically, and the way in which we can use surviving forms of words in living languages to reconstruct the lost forms in dead languages. Comparative philology is a fascinating discipline. And interestingly, it's a discipline which has a history all its own. I'm going to be talking a little bit about this history in some later lectures, but I think it's important now to say a few words about what is comparative about comparative philology and where the term comes from. In the middle of the 18th century, people were comparing many things. Fossils were being discovered, and scientists were comparing fossils to reconstruct earlier forms of animals that had gone extinct. Comparative anatomy, or comparative paleontology, began to develop as a way of understanding the growth, development, and later the evolution of species. Comparative philology takes its very term from these earlier scientific disciplines. It is, as it were, the paleontology of language, the way in which fossilized forms are compared and reconstructed to give us these older dead forms. Articulatory phonetics, sociolinguistics, and comparative philology are the three basic tools for the study of the history of language. But what will we be studying with these tools? I think we can divide up our field of study into four basic areas: pronunciation, grammar or morphology, meaning or semantic change, and attitudes towards language change. Pronunciation is, of course, the way in which people actually spoke. But how can we recover the way in which people actually spoke? What is the relationship between speech and writing? What is the relationship between the prescriptions for speech and descriptions of regional variation or individual idiosyncrasy or idiom? The history of pronunciation is intimately linked to the history of sounds themselves. The study of the history of sounds is phonology. And pronunciation and phonology can become a major point of inquiry for our reconstruction of earlier forms of the English language. Grammar seems to us to be quite simply the way in which words are put together to make meaningful sentences or meaningful utterances. But grammar is a very complicated set of problems. And perhaps a better, though more technical way of talking about it is to use a word like morphology. Now, morphology just means the form of things. If you were an anatomist or a paleontologist, you would use the word to describe the forms of species or of animals. If you are a grammarian, you use the word morphology to mean the forms of words. And so morphology embraces things like case endings, the study of grammatical endings. Morphology also embraces things like the forms of personal pronouns, the system of personal pronouns. Do you have a singular and a plural second person pronoun? Some languages do. Early English did. Modern English really doesn't. Looking at phenomena such as these are really looking at morphology. Meaning or semantics. Semantics is a word that gets bandied about today. Semantics, I think, has a bad rap. It's just a question of semantics. But the history of language is a question of semantics. How do word meanings change? How can a word that seems stable in pronunciation and in spelling seem over time to change so radically in meaning? We'll be looking at many of these. A word like silly is a marvelous example. Silly today means odd or childlike or risible, laughable. But 1,000 years ago, selig, Old English for silly. Middle English, silly, was blessed, touched by the Lord, infused with the Spirit of grace. Someone who was blessed, infused with the Spirit of grace, might seem to behave differently from the rest of us. Such a person might seem odd, might seem different, might in short seem silly. A word that originally described the inner and spiritual quality of an individual comes to refer to the outer and behavioral aspect of the individual. This is an example of semantic change. And we're going to be charting the semantic changes of many important words, and we're also going to be looking at how we can use the phenomenon of semantic change to understand social attitudes and literary and cultural conventions, as it were, to write history through the history of words. And attitudes towards language change, perhaps the purview of sociolinguistics, again, the way in which individuals record their notions of how language changes. Is language something that should be fixed and immutable, or is language something that is fluid and ever-changing? We're going to be looking through this course at a series of metaphors or images for language change. Is language like a river, as many scholars from antiquity to the present have argued? It's always flowing and always changing, but it's always there. Is language like a tree, which begins with a seed and moves through its branches and leaves to its fruit? Is language like an individual, growing and developing? What are the metaphors of language? Is language something which is sublunary, a favorite word of earlier scholars in the 16th and the 17th century? Sublunary, living under the domination of the moon, mutable, changing. Is language an earthly phenomenon, or is it something with a higher or a deeper spirit? When we look at language change, then, in these areas, we need not just to clarify what we're looking at and how we're looking at it, but we need to judge the quality of our evidence. What constitutes evidence for language change? I think, broadly speaking, there are three categories. Everybody asks me, how do you know how Shakespeare's language should be pronounced? How do you know how Chaucer sounded? How do you know that in Old English certain sounds were the way they were? I think there are ways of answering this. We don't know things with certainty, but I think we can use particular methods and devices to come up with, as it were, a very narrow margin of reasonable doubt. First, let's think about written evidence. People spoke certainly before they wrote. Language is not writing. But what is the relationship between speech and writing? Let me rephrase the question as a philologist. How can I use the evidence from writing of how people actually spoke? What I want is not a beautifully formed text written by a highly educated individual. What I want, ideally, is a handwritten document, preferably a letter, or maybe a journal entry, or perhaps a diary of some kind, or maybe a little bit of marginalia in a manuscript, by someone who is just educated enough to be able to write, but not so educated that that individual is recording conventions of spelling rather than the sounds of speech. In other words, your best evidence for language pronunciation is of the barely literate rather than the fully or highly literate. Earlier scribes tend to record speech sounds. And in certain periods that we'll be looking at, in particular the period of Middle English, the time of Chaucer, scribes regionally described their own dialects. In other words, the conventions of writing in the 13th, 14th, and 15th century are the conventions of recording your regional dialect. Spelling varies greatly in these texts, and scholars have been able to reconstruct dialect pronunciation on the basis of these regionally different spellings. A modern example of this, which we will look at towards the close of this course, is what's called I-dialect. That is, the way in which certain literary writers try to represent regional dialects or personal idiom by spelling words in funny ways. That is, the purpose of these writers is not to record, as a phonetician would, the actual sounds, but rather to evoke, by certain conventions of spelling, certain conventions of pronunciation. If I were to write S-E-Z, or if I were to write W-A-N-N-A, says or wanna, I'd be writing I dialect. I say, he says, and I wanna go. But by writing it in that way, we indicate something about the regional or dialectical pronunciation. In other words, we don't record a sound, we evoke an impression of a sound. So these are some examples of how we can use written evidence. Now, in addition to that, we can know something about how people spoke by using sound laws. I'm going to be talking about this when we look at Indo-European and when we look at Old English. But scholars have been able to reconstruct historically how sounds have changed. If you know certain rules or laws of sound change, you can work backwards. If you know what a sound was in one language and what it was in another language, you can work backwards to a parent language. If you know something about the great vowel shift, as we will by the end of the course, you'll know something about earlier forms of pronunciation. And the third main category for understanding how people actually spoke was to look at manuals of speech. For example, documents that actually try to record speech, or a particularly fascinating set of documents, ways in which children were taught to speak and read Latin in the medieval schools. The correct pronunciation of Latin was very often calibrated to the pronunciation of the vernacular. And so what you have is almost by accident a set of documents that teach us how people spoke the vernacular, even though they were designed to teach children how to speak Latin. I also want to ask some questions, not just about how to study language, but about what language is. Now, as I mentioned, this is a question that has been motivating scholars and critics for millennia. But I think we can come up with some general guidelines here. I'd like to posit that we think of language as something which is a form of social and human behavior. In other words, no language is inherently more grammatical than any other. No earlier form of a language is any simpler than any other. No later form is more complex. Language is a working system of communication. People communicate in different languages as adequately as in any other language. And people of 1,000 years ago, I would presume, communicated just as well as we do now. This isn't just my sentiment, it's Chaucer's. And we'll see when we look at Chaucer's English how Chaucer himself reflects on the language of 1,000 years before him and his own argument that people were able to do just as well in love and war as they could in his own day. Languages have rules and conventions of successful communication. But throughout history, people have judged language and language performance, as well as judging individual linguistic competence. One of the things we're going to have to understand as we work through this course is what the nature of language is as reflected by individual usage. How does the usage of an individual tell us something about language in the large? Can we use the evidence of individual speakers to tell us something about the linguistic community? And to review my claims in my previous lecture, should the study of language be prescriptive or descriptive? In studying the history of the English language, we're looking at a history that moves along these two axes of prescriptivism and descriptivism. In fact, I would like to suggest that we may not even be able to draw the line between the prescriptive and the descriptive. Every act of describing is an act of prescribing. And the more authoritative, or the more educated, or the more compelling the describer, the more persuasive the prescription. I want to close this lecture with what I call four myths of language. That is, four sets of attitudes that condition or shape our everyday understanding of language and the way in which we can use them and disabuse ourselves of them productively in our course of study. The first I call the myth of universality. There is, as far as we can tell, no such thing as a universal language. There's no utterance that's completely understandable to every human being. Now, I know someone will say, well, what about a word like mama? Doesn't every language have a word mama? Doesn't every language signal maternity by mama? Well, in the language of the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, the Georgian language, a language unrelated to Indo-European, Semitic, Asian, it's a language family unique to itself. The word for mother is deda, and the word for father is mama. I think this is an excellent example of the myth of universality. Of course, in the 18th century, as some of us may remember, as some of us may know, in the 18th century it was a commonplace for kings or princes or for philosophers to find wild children or to take children and put them in isolation and imagine that they would learn to speak. And when they learned to speak, that would be an original, an Adamic, an Edenic language. Some scholars today, in fact, have posited that there is such a thing as an original language and have used comparative philology to work back even before Indo-European. And I'll be saying a few things about that towards the close of this course. But I think we need to say at the beginning that we cannot at present posit a universal form of language. My second myth is the myth of simplicity. No language is harder or simpler for its own speech community to learn. 6-year-olds in any culture speak their own language with the same degree of competence or ability. No language, similarly, is any simpler or more complex at different historical periods. It may seem to us that English has become simpler grammatically, but English has become far more complex idiomatically. Languages do not decay, they do not get corrupted, they do not evolve into higher forms. So a corollary of the myth of simplicity is what I call the myth of teleology. Language change does not move towards a goal. There is not an ideal form of a language that we are somehow imperceptibly moving towards. Languages do not evolve from lower forms into higher forms. Thus, language does not change gradually. The myth of gradualism is what I call it. Language changes over time, but these changes operate in fits and starts. Something like the Great Vowel Shift radically changed the way in which English was pronounced over a period of about a century. Yet, the history of English pronunciation may seem relatively stable for long periods of time other than that. Language may change, too, semantically. In the end of the 16th century, at the time of Shakespeare, words were changing meanings very, very quickly. Shakespeare can exploit the multiplicity of meanings of different words. Yet, we may be able to read certain texts that are 100 or 150 years old and not see much change at all. I think what's at stake here is that language changes at different rates and at different times. Universality, simplicity, teleology, gradualism. What I'm calling four myths of the history of language. Now, when we look in particular at languages in the subsequent lectures, and when we look in particular at the Indo-European languages in the next few lectures, we're going to be looking not just at the methods of study, in particular comparative philology, study of semantic change, but we're also going to be looking at the practitioners of those methods. How was the history of language inflected or textured by holders of these myths? When William Jones, as we will see next time, discovers relationships among the European and the Indian languages, is he led to a sense of linguistic diversity, or is he led to a sense of linguistic universality? When 19th century philologists develop notions of sound laws and language change, are they looking at teleologies, movements towards a goal? Is the discipline of historical linguistics itself one that is founded in these myths? What we will be doing in our next couple of lectures will be looking at precisely this set of problems as we explore the history of Indo-European philology and its many practitioners. But before I close this lecture, I just want to say a few things about why we're moving in this direction. This is, of course, in the history of English. It may seem as if we have a ways to go before we get to English. The study of the prehistory of English, I'm suggesting, is essential to our study of its history and its afterlife. The methods that we use, the attitudes we hold, the myths that we believe in, and the texts and textures of our language can in many ways be traced back to a prehistorical Indo-European set of contexts. But finally, I just want to say that I am so personally fascinated by these early forms of the language, and so amazed that scholars can reconstruct these texts and contexts, that I simply want to share with you my thrill and my enthusiasm for the possible recovery of a lost historical and linguistic world. So till next time, when we look at Indo-European, I'll leave you with a thought of simplicity, of universality, of teleology, and gradualism. Things we may believe, but things that we will see evaporated before our eyes in the study of texts now thousands of years old. Thank you.